Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids. So welcome to the next edition of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Keno McGregor. She's our special guest for this month. And she doesn't really need any introduction from me. She's written several books, Miami Life Center, Om Stars, so many things that you've done. And I really appreciate you being on the show today, Keno.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I would love to talk about the Keno before she found yoga. You know, a big part of our podcast is like talking about like people's why and like where they were beforehand. So can you tell us a little bit about who Keno was before she started to find yoga?
Well, I think there are sort of two threads that are important to talk about here. And the first is that, you know, in many ways I was searching without realizing I was searching. I was lost without realizing I was lost. And it was a way for me to see myself when I look back. I can see two things. I can see, first of all, from the time I'm 9 years old, maybe even before, that I've suffered through periods of depression. And it was undiagnosed and untreated for the majority of my life. And it was in very dark periods, very down periods, where I would start to really quest and search outside of myself. And sometimes that led to drug use. And eventually it led me into, you know, yoga, but it took me through a few dark turns in the first, you know, in the first instance. I wouldn't have known that I was depressed before. And I wouldn't have known that I had this kind of big hole in my heart. I wouldn't have known what I was questing for. There was just this unresolved angst that I felt inside. And I felt wherever I got a little bit of relief, then I think I gravitated towards that. And I did my first yoga class when I was 19 years old, and it was a Shivananda style class. And from that moment until the time I was 22, I did yoga out of books and kind of on my own, and just kind of, you know, did whatever poses I could find in books, and kind of taught myself a little bit of, you know, yoga. And again, with that first class that I went to, kind of began the journey. But I remember when I was, you know, 22 years old, and I was partying, using a lot of drugs, and really lost. And I remember feeling that the drugs weren't working anymore. Like, I wasn't able to get that feeling of like, wow, I'm, you know, in another world, like everything's blissful. So like those initial experiences of the high, they were gone. And then the anger and the rage and the irresolution was back. And then I also kind of saw, you know, like the path forward. I was like, if I don't change my life, it's just going to be gone. You know, and I saw some people that had been in the party culture that I was in and never got out. And it really inspired me to get out, you know, and it was those two things. And then I came to a dedicated practice of Ashtanga yoga because I remember saying to myself, I need to learn how to live a more peaceful life. Gotcha. So that's what brought me in. That's what brought me into the practice of yoga. And
was it not peaceful because of just like your circumstances with like partying and stuff, or did you just not feel peaceful on the inside as well?
Oh gosh. Well, I don't know if anybody's ever peaceful in the midst of, you know, rave culture and ecstasy culture and that kind of thing. I don't know if anyone's really actually peaceful. You know, there's a lot of, you know, peace, love, and happiness that's around, but it's all chemically assisted. So then there are these intense highs and intense lows. And then there's, you know, the addictive qualities related to the, you know, to the drug itself and that kind of thing. So, I mean, for me, it was this idea of the recognition that there was a lack of peace in my life. I wanted to learn who I was, and, you know, I wanted to learn how to be at peace with myself and with the world around me. And, you know, I wasn't raised with any conventional religion. I wasn't raised, you know, my grandfather's Buddhist. My parents were, you know, secular, kind of, you know, secular spiritualist, you could say, and they raised me without religion. And so there was always a question in my heart about, you know, is there a God? is there a God? Who God is? That sort of thing. I was always asking those questions, and it was never really definitive what the answer was. So I brought this all to the practice of yoga, like all my questions. And the reason why I think I was able to lay that on the altar of Ashtanga yoga was because of the felt sense of what my body experienced. You know, from the first class that I did, I remember lying at the end of the class, you know, when everything was over, you're totally sweaty. And then there was this experience of stillness. My mind stopped, my body was at rest, and I felt just an immense feeling of peace, of oneness, of true bliss, you know? And I just knew I had to keep practicing. And I just started practicing more and more. Within a year of that, I was in India, you know, and then I have been practicing, you know, 6 days a week for like the last 20 years.
Wow. And so how did you kind of come to the, like, you know, the decision that you were going to go to India? Like, how did that happen?
Well, I had heard after the end of a practice that in this traditional Mysore style practice, I'd heard that a couple students were going to go to India to practice, you know, in Mysore, in the small South Indian city where this, you know, Ashtanga yoga originates from. Something in my heart just leapt up and was like, I want to go too. I didn't know anything about it. I'm a bit impulsive. And I immediately was like, yeah, right. And I was like, I want to go too. And so I just ran up and was like, I want to go too. Can I sign up? Is it a field trip? Like, how do I, like, where do we all go? You know, and then I was told, you know, all the procedures, you know, you need to write a letter to this, you know, address at the, you know, the Ashtanga Yoga Nilayam and send this letter. And the way it was in those old days was you send this letter off to India, and if you don't hear back, then you can go. So, you know,
so old school.
And I had a dream about going to India too. So this is very much what kind of, you know, I woke up from the dream and I just said, you know, I've got to go to India. And so I sent the letter, I bought my tickets 2 weeks later, I got a 10-year visa, and I started what would be the beginning of annual trips to India.
Wow. And so what was your first experience of India? Was that like the first, like, third world country or developing country that you've actually been to?
Yeah, India was a whole other experience, unlike anything I'd ever been to. I'd been to Asia as a child because I'm part Japanese, and we would go over to visit my grandfather's family, you know, outside of Tokyo in Chiba. But I had not been to Southeast Asia, India, the India subcontinent. I hadn't been to the Middle East or anything like that. So it was my first exposure to that culture, and I was just floored. You know, And at the same time, because I'm from Miami, the thing that I was also kind of taken aback by was how similar the plants and the air and the humidity is, right? You know? So I remember getting off the airplane and stepping out of the airport around 5 a.m. in Bangalore and seeing palm trees and jacaranda trees and bougainvillea and feeling like, wow, this doesn't look so different than Florida. And then, of course, the air is drier. But then there was this feeling of familiarity. And there's this sound, which perhaps you remember from Mysore as well, but there's the sound of a particular bird called the Asian crow.
And
that, like, whooping sound was the thing that I would just hear all the time because, you know, the doors and the windows are open and everything's, you know, exposed in terms of the air when you're staying in most homes and, you know, in South India. And I just remember that sound of that bird. And it just embedded itself in my, you know, in my brain and in my heart. So still to this day, when I hear that sound, I feel a little bit like, oh, Mysore. Oh, those old days in India.
And so when you were first, like, going, did you go after, like, your first year of practice, or was it a couple years, or was it just a few months into it?
I'd been practicing less than a year, like 6 or 7 months when I sent the letter. And when I arrived to Mysore, I'd been practicing for like maybe 10 months.
Wow. And you walk into, like, the shala and tell me, like, your first experience with practice in there.
So So I practiced, this was my very first trip to India, and I practiced on this trip at the old shala in Lakshmipuram. Mm-hmm. And it was my first trip there. And it was like the last year that shala was open. And there were very few students registered at the time. There were like 40 students. And, you know, I remember that the only address I had in Mysore was the Ashtanga Yoga Nilayam, you know, the old shala where Patabi Joyce used to teach. And I remember that the car ride, it dropped me off there, and I got out of the car. I walked into the shala, and Patabi Joyce was the first person that I saw. So I looked into his eyes, and I just, you know, immediately knew that I wanted to practice, and something in my heart opened to the whole experience. And I can look back now, and I can see that it was very much that first trip to India that really, really sort of changed the direction of my life and made it possible to be, you know, really, really dedicated to the practice of yoga.
And so I'm wondering, you know, because you mentioned depression, I mean, has your yoga practice helped you with depression? It has helped with mine, but I'm just wondering your experience with, you know, like the depression that you were feeling when you were kind of like the party girl.
Oh, yeah. You know, the first thing that happened for me was the more yoga I did, the less partying
sure.
I did. And then it took... I remember after my first trip to India, I came back and I just knew that I could never go on like a late night bender again. I just couldn't do it, you know? And I had been still within that first year, like I would come and practice really intensively, but then I would still somehow sneak in like a party session on Friday night and somehow be semi-recovered for Sunday. And I was doing that for the first year of practice. After I came back from India, it was like, I just can't, like I can't anymore. And I went through this period of like mourning where I felt like I'm never going to be that person again. That identity, all of the feelings and all of the friends and all of that, everything was associated with that. Like that's all gone now. So it's, and I went through this mourning. It was this like loss of an identity. It sounds really bizarre, but it was like a conscious, all these images of, and all these feelings and all the good times related to that. It had just sort of reached its end. And, I said goodbye to it. And it, you know, yoga changed my life. Then I'm getting up at a different time. I'm eating different things. I'm, you know, no longer partying on the weekends. Unfortunately, what that also meant, or fortunately rather than unfortunately, is that I had to sit with all my stuff, you know. And there was no escape. It was like, wow, there's no escape. I started meditating when I came back from India, and that was a really, really big tool. So I've also practiced Vipassana meditation for around 19 years. And yeah, that combination though is what's really helped me sort out my mind. So the physical stuff, the physical asana is sort of the foundation of the experience of the body, being able to bring you into, you know, more refined, subtle sensibilities of what the body feels and how the body in motion works, and bringing a sense of re-embodiment from all of those, you know, traumatizing experiences that often break our hearts when we're children, you know, whether it's, you know, big trauma with a capital T or small trauma with a lowercase t, whichever one we have in our life. And I have, you know, early childhood, you know, sexual trauma, and I never dealt with it and I never processed it and all of the things that has impacted in regards to my psyche. You know, first I needed to get into my body, and asana really helped and still continues to keep me embodied. But then in the sense of embodiment, the practice of Vipassana with its emphasis on mindfulness and the felt sense of the body has helped me really be able to process all of the trauma that was stored, as well as move into a space of clarity, healing, you know, peace, and ultimately, you know, of love, you know, for myself and even for the difficult experiences and all that.
Yeah. And, you know, so you talk about trauma. I mean, you know, like recently, you know, obviously there's been in the Ashtanga community, there's been sort of like a huge amount of trauma that has been coming up associated with Patabi Joyce. And so I'm wondering if like you can give some thoughts on like, you know, the method and like, you know, and also like this kind of the situation that we have going on right now.
Well, this is an ongoing conversation, and I think it's one that requires compassion and an appreciation for all the different perspectives of everyone that's involved. So I need to first acknowledge all of the victims who have been really brave in speaking out and state very clearly that it's, while I'm not, you know, an independent adjudicator or judge, jury, and, you know, trial in this, from everything that I can estimate based on what our teacher, Sharat Joyce, you know, Pratabi Joyce's grandson, has confirmed, as well as eyewitness accounts of, you know, senior teachers that practiced exclusively in the Lakshmi Puram Shala, as well as the, you know, the harrowing accounts of the victim stories, it seems abundantly evident that, you know, Pratabi Joyce touched some women inappropriately, and that the experience was long-lasting trauma, some of whom are not healed even to this day, 20, 30 years later. And so that's devastating. And it's something that we as Ashtanga Yoga practitioners, you know, we need to take a serious look at. I have to contextualize myself within that. So while I practiced with Pratabi Joyce, I never once saw him touch anyone inappropriately. I was never touched inappropriately, and nobody ever talked to me about the sexual assault that was going on. So I never saw him sexually assault anyone. I never saw him, you know, have his hands in, you know, women or men's private parts. I was never privy to any of these discussions. So it's floored me. It's really taken me a long time to process, because he was a hero of mine. And it's really difficult to work through all of my own feelings and work through, you know, and take it to a place of potential growth. And at the same time, be very compassionate and understanding to the victims who are still processing their trauma. And there's a feeling of anger, betrayal, you know, disillusionment, disheartenment, all of that directed at the man, Pratabi Joyce, you know? And I feel very much like I just found this out about my grandfather, because that's the kind of love that I had and still have for him. And I feel that it's really, really challenging, you know? And contextually, you know, I'm a sexual assault survivor. So my first sexual experience was rape, and that continued. You know, I from the time I'm 11 years old until the time I'm 14 years old, I, you know, am in situations where men who were 4 to 5 times my age, you know, I can look back now and I can say, you know, raped me. And I didn't have the tools at the time to say no. I was 11 years old, and I, you know, took me 20 years to tell the story to anyone. So I know what it's like to walk around with shame. When I was 25 years old, I walked into a yoga studio and a yoga teacher raped me. So this is something that happens to women and men in society. You know, there are these statistics that, you know, that are true, and they're heartbreaking. Every 92 seconds in the United States, someone is sexually assaulted. So this means that during the time that we've been speaking, numerous assaults have been taking place. And these are people whose lives are forever traumatized. And that sucks. 1 in 6 women has been the victim of rape or attempted rape. 1 in 33 men has been a victim of rape or attempted rape. When you think about that, here we are teaching a yoga class. There's 50 people. This means that there's a percentage of trauma survivors, people that are the victims of rape or attempted rape, in the room. And it's like really astounding, you know, and it's overwhelming. And then people come to yoga and they think yoga is a safe space. And then what happens? Their teacher, the esteemed teacher who's venerated as a guru, then, you know, violates them and perpetuates the systemic abuse that is already endemic in culture.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
And it's not okay. It's not okay.
You know, I had a lot of feelings about it too. It took me a really long time to process. You know, we ended up obviously taking Pratabi Joyce's picture down and having conversations about it. We opened up dialogue to have some healing, you know, but I think the biggest thing for me is, like, I was angry. I was never a student at Pratabi Joyce, but I was angry at the fact that this guy was put up on a pedestal and, like, given this power. And that felt like a lie, but the practice didn't feel like a lie. And my teacher, Sharat Joyce, didn't feel like a lie either. He felt like a real human being. And that speaks to me. But, like, to a certain extent, I feel like there's some people that have kind of been tricked or something like that, or at least I feel tricked. And And so it's interesting, like, you know, I'm also a sexual assault survivor, you know, happened when I was really young. And, you know, it brought up those feelings as well. Like, maybe I don't want to actually be a part of this community. And so it's taken me a really long time to kind of process it, too. It's a really hard week.
Yeah.
Really hard week.
Yeah. And another, like, the things to think about is, like, you know, here we are and we're doing this practice. It's benefited us. So we're both survivors of sexual assault. We've come to this practice in many ways. It's been a path of healing for us. We were never violated and we never saw any violations happen. And if we go into practice with Sharat, there are no, under no circumstances, does Sharat in any way, you know, perpetuating any sort of, you know, sexual assault, nor is he normalizing it, nor is he condoning it in any way. And that's, like, that's really important. Like, Ashtanga yoga right now, as it is now, if you come into my class, come into your class, you come into Sharat's class in terms of creating a safe space that is a clear boundary so that, you know, women and men are not, you know, sexually assaulted, touched inappropriately, or that they're, it's there. Like, it's a safe space now in that context. And so that's important to understand in terms of the practice. A second thing that helped me process is, without drawing any further comparisons, the idea that a flawed man or woman, a flawed human being, as we all are flawed, can at the same time tap into and receive and develop a system that has beautiful ideals and is a solid system of practice. That's possible. Like, those two things can coexist. And the example that came, there's two examples that came to me. One is like a more sort of personal one, and another one is kind of like a more broader societal one. And without drawing any further comparisons, you know, they're two totally different examples, but one of the things that helped me understand how I can reconcile that in my mind is that, you know, in the United States right now, we are deconstructing our own history as North Americans. And one of the things that we're doing is going back and realizing that our founding fathers, like George Washington and, you know, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson and all these people that wrote the founding principles of the United States of America, lived with the great hypocrisy that they were all slave owners and that they owned slaves. And so it's like, if you read the Declaration of Independence, it's beautiful, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And, you know, we're born with certain inalienable rights, and that's this dream of, like, that you, because you are a being and you are, you know, that you have these rights that are innate and inherent to your nature. And how can we create a system of government that honors that? And at the same time, these people own slaves, and they perpetuated a system of systemic racism, oppression, and abuse. And, you know, they also didn't include women in the Constitution. So it was like these marginalized groups were excluded from the dream of the United States of America. And it was built on, you know, or predicated on a notion of, you know, white male privilege and, you know, white male dominance. And at the same time, you know, and so that's all true. And the dream of the United States of America, and it's beautiful, you know? So, like, we can't, we're going to throw away the whole premise of democracy and equality and all of these things, or, you know, because we found these things out about the founding fathers, or do we instead recognize their flaws and learn from them so that we can be, you know, create a better future going forward? So I think that's where I am with Ashtanga yoga. I recognize, you know, this is the system, and that you know, Patabi Joyce received from his teacher and made some updates to, and now Sharat's teaching it. And now we're all recipients of the practice. And the place where I think we are right now is we're at a really amazing time in Ashtanga, because we have this vantage point from which we can start to, you know, make some updates to the system. And we can start to think about, well, what do we want, you know, Ashtanga yoga to mean going forward? And what is the essence of the practice? In the very same way that perhaps, you know, the United States as a nation state is questioning those same things. You know, what is democracy? And what does it mean to be free? And what does it mean to stand for equality? So how can we, you know, create a, you know, as Americans, a system of government that can truly embody what we stand for. As Ashtanga yogi practitioners, how can we create a system of Ashtanga yoga that truly embodies the true potential of this practice and, you know, embraces the goodness?
Right. I think the best part is that the awareness is there now, and it's taken us, I feel like, a little in my opinion, a little too long to recognize the truth. And but now we have awareness around it. And now, like you said, we have opportunity. And that that opportunity is like, you know, now we can basically create a dialogue, and that dialogue can create change and create a better, even a better system with more accountability and you know, obviously more checks and balances and things like that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and then there are some big, there are big picture questions about Ashtanga yoga. You know, one of the things I think, one of the things I think is important is to create a dedicated accountability structure for teachers, you know. So whether that's within Ashtanga yoga or within yoga at large, one of the things that I'm really realizing myself when I walked out of that yoga class and I was just assaulted by this yoga teacher is I had no one to talk to. So what I think would be amazing, and this is what I'm working on with some really powerful collaborators in both the yoga world and also in the nonprofit space, which supports survivors of sexual assault, to create some sort of system so that survivors can, or people who are victims before they, that they can have resources available. They can contact a therapist. They can contact someone that can walk them through the procedure. Eventually, the idea would be that there would be, you know, money for legal support and money for therapy. So that's something that I'm working on. Within Ashtanga yoga itself, here are some like big picture sort of questions. Right now, Ashtanga yoga as it's set up favors, you know, young, able-bodied, so thin, strong, flexible, financially stable students who are able to make multiple trips to India. And that's kind of exclusionary, you know? So yeah, sure. I mean, our question now is kind of how, or at least what I'm sitting with is, this practice is amazing. So how can we make it accessible? You know, my mom, who's 75 years old and has two total knee replacements, she wanted to come practice. So I'm like, okay, so how can I make this practice accessible for her so she can benefit from it? So that it's not, you know, it's not only young, you know, able-bodied, financially stable or supported people that can benefit from this practice. So the question of accessibility is really, really important. The question of inclusivity, I think, is an important dialogue in Ashtanga yoga. You know, this practice tends to be embraced by dominant cultures. And so it's something that comes from, you know, origin India, people of color. So how can we make sure that Ashtanga yoga is, you know, justly available to marginalized groups as well as people with, you know, economic privilege and economic means to be able to afford classes? And this is an important question that, you know, I think our style of yoga is really facing right now.
Yeah, I thought one of the biggest breaths of fresh air that I got with this is, you know, with the Trini Foundation, you know, we teach addicts to, you know, practice Ashtanga yoga. And I remember sitting with Sharat, who is an honorary director of the organization. And he said to me, what happens if we just gave a scholarship to every one of your addiction students or people that are struggling with addiction? And we gave them the ability to come to India free of tuition. And I was like, Yes. I mean, you know, I was like, the Trini Foundation could help pay for it and all this stuff. And Sharat, like, I mean, it just felt like a really breath of fresh air, because it also felt, and this was a couple of years ago, where it was just like, oh yeah, there needs to be more, you know, these little sub categories of people. Like, it needs to be more accessible to people, you know, continually. And so, and obviously in my case, I deal with addiction a lot. You know, and some of the stuff you're talking about with, you know, your grandma or your mom or, you know, any of the sexual abuse survivors or any of that stuff. Like, I mean, it needs to be like, you know, there needs to be access to it.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So to ask ourselves, you know, how can we as a community do that? And you're already doing that with your work at the Trini Foundation. And, you know, sometimes I think, like, wouldn't it be amazing if there was, you know, like an organization that would actually create scholarships for, you know, students within marginalized communities to travel to India or to continue their studies or to support them in their journey somehow. And how can we take a stand for the things that are really, really meaningful?
Yeah. And, you know, because the practice to me, it means so much to me. I mean, it literally, I mean, you mentioned this earlier that it saved your life, but I mean, it saved me from putting needles in my arms and living in crack houses and things like that. And, you know, it gave me a completely different outcome. Like, I've been blessed with this opportunity of a second chance and, you know, like sobriety and family and, you know, all of these things that I never had before. And that's all because of the practice. And so, yeah, it needs to be accessible to people, but also it's like, you know, it changed my life. Like, I feel indebted to it. Do you also feel indebted to it as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's the, I feel that this is the reason that I stay inspired to keep teaching. You know, this is why I stay inspired to keep sharing things online and keeping a public presence and these sorts of things. So I know the good it does. And I know the good that it's done me personally. And I just feel committed to, you know, bringing the practice to more people, making it more accessible because of that life-saving feature of the practice. And this is why I think it's been so difficult for so many people to grapple with the issues that are being presented, because, you know, while I think that everyone who practices Ashtanga yoga, their hearts are open and, you know, they're developing more compassion and they're willing to put in the work to make it right in regards to what's happened with Patabi Joyce. And at the same time, you know, the empirical truth of this practice saved me. You know, this practice has such value that, you know, there's this, I think intelligent resistance to throwing it out, you know? So like some people have said to me recently, or have written me kind of, you know, emotional and very charged messages demanding that I stop practicing Ashtanga yoga, that I stop teaching Ashtanga yoga, that I disavow and denounce Ashtanga yoga. And and I'm like, you know, I'm sorry, and I'm not there. I'm not there. I believe in the method, you know. I really believe in the method, and we can make updates to the method, you know. It's like this amazing, you know, program that we're running on the body. We could totally make updates to it. I'm all for that, but I'm not at the place where that I believe that it should be thrown out because of the mistakes of one person who, yes, did so much to propagate the practice and is so connected to the, you know, the practice. And then, so that's something to sit with is, you know, how can we do this work in a constructive way, you know, to embrace both the positive aspects of the practice and at the same time to honor, you know, the journey of healing, acknowledgement and recognition that's needed from, you know, the survivor and victim perspective. I, for one, in terms of my own experience of being raped by a yoga teacher, I have never gotten any sort of acknowledgement, definitely not from him, and not from any of the community that surrounded him. And, you know, it was a known fact that this guy did that. I'm not the only woman that he raped and assaulted. And it was sort of a known fact. Nobody warned me. And nobody really had any sort of restorative actions that were done after. And people that I shared with just, you know, wrote it off. Oh, that's how he is. Oh, that's what he's about. Oh, that's who he is. And some people that's even bought terrible. Into Yeah, some people even bought into the myth of, yeah, you know, this guy, he's a real teacher, and you could have really learned something from that if you would have just opened to the experience.
That's,
you know,
just ignorant.
You know, like, I know what it's like to feel like, you know, you're never going to get the acknowledgement, you know, or recognition from a community around people. And, you know, you go and you share your story and you tell people. And, you know, the guy that I'm referring to, and I'm just not even going to mention his name, is the last time I checked, he's still listed as EYRT 500 with Yoga Alliance. So, you know, when it happened, I shared the story with Yoga Alliance, and they sent me an email back that was the stock email that was like, it said something along the lines of, you know, due to the high volume of emails that we receive, we're not able to attend to each one individually. I never heard back from them. Then, you know, Yoga Alliance has tried to go through this new like renovation where they brought in a new team, and they reached out to me, and, you know, I shared my story with them again. And then they had a lawyer contact me, and I shared my story with their lawyer. And the end result was, unless you decide to press criminal charges, you know, and then this man is convicted in the United States court of law, then we can take no action. Yeah. And I just felt like, you know, they could have hired an independent adjudicator to address the issue. They could have investigated on their own, and they could have, you know, presented the case to a panel that could pass judgment on him and then decide whether they believe the story or not, and then decide whether they want the person to be listed or not listed. But they're not even willing to do that, you know? And there has to be more recourse in the community. So all of that to say, you know, there are many flawed things about, you know, our teacher Sharat's, you know, public post acknowledging that his grandfather did commit these acts of sexual violence against some of his students. But there is also a huge thing to be said for the fact that he has publicly acknowledged this, because that means the entire Ashtanga yoga community, regardless of whether or not you practice with Patabi Joyce or you're a new practitioner, now, you know, embraces the victim story.
Like, right. I think that was a huge first step. Maybe absolutely. it wasn't said exactly right, but I definitely think it was a step in the right direction towards healing.
Absolutely. You know, there are many things that could have been, you know, edited and updated about that, but to really understand that step, like his public acknowledgement of the actions of Patabi Joyce, normalizes the discourse and verifies it for so many people that either, you know, never experienced it, were unaware that this was happening. You know, like there are people who are not on social media. I just spoke with someone over the weekend that I shared this, you know, the who's an Ashtanga yoga practitioner and who's not on social media. And I shared what was going on, and she had no idea because she's just not online. She just goes and practices and that's it. And I shared with her everything that was happening. And for her, you know, she said, well, you know, if Sharat says it happened, then I absolutely believe it happened. And you know, and so for her that was kind of the necessary confirmation. And I know that's frustrating for people who are victims because they want to be believed on their own terms. I understand how that feels. I really understand how that feels. And this is why, like, you know, if we ever bring charges or accusations against somebody, it's almost, you need to recuse yourself if you are a lawyer or a juror or a judge, if you have a personal relation, because as soon as you have a personal relation, there's so much loyalty and love that clouds your judgment. So it's just very, very difficult when you have a personal relationship with someone to, you know, change your opinion about them. It's really hard.
So in the midst of like all of this turmoil, like how do you continually show up on your mat? Like, you know, and why are you showing up on your mat on a consistent basis?
So this is a really deep question, because what we have to go into is, you know, the nature of practice of the guru and all of that, because, you know, we start off the Ashtanga yoga with this opening prayer, you know, one day guru nam, and then it's like, well, wait a minute. Oh, why am I bowing down to this guru if he acted like this, you know? And so that's a really relevant question. And my highest guru is God. So I believe that the only perfect being is God. And, you know, we are perfect in our imperfection, but that God is really the only total guru, this, you know, higher divine presence, source, however we prefer to call the divine, is the only being to whom which absolute and total surrender is really recommended or, you know, feasible. Every time we surrender completely to a human being, we unfortunately will meet face to face their foibles and their, you know, infinitely fallible nature, myself included. I am not a guru. I am not an enlightened master. I'm just a human being trying to figure out how to live a more peaceful life. And so when I come to the practice, I'm practicing for myself. I'm practicing for my own connection to, you know, a more peaceful life. I'm practicing as prayer. I'm practicing as my time of worship, of sacred space, of holy communion. And that's what brings me back to the mat. That's what brings me into my body. That's what brings me into my meditation practice. I recently did two more Vipassana meditation retreats, and, you know, you're asked to not, you know, to not do any intensive asana during that time period. But you're sitting all day, and I couldn't resist to do a few poses. And I had, so much more respect, like renewed respect and enthusiasm for the physical asana practice, just sitting all day and feeling what that does to the legs and the body, even though the mind is in this very subtle and refined state, to come out of long sits and then to do Trikonasana and then to do, you know, simple warrior poses and things like that, and to feel the energy and the blood circulation and all of those positive benefits about embodiment really start to come. So this is very much my reason for coming back to the mat, that it is my holy space. It is my communion and my connection time. I'm not in it to achieve asana anymore. I'm not in it to try to get the next pose. I'm not in it to, you know, force something that doesn't want to be into being. I'm in it to just breathe and be with my body in a time of prayer.
Oh, that's beautiful. And so let's take a couple different questions. Like, you know, I mean, obviously Instagram following, you have a huge Instagram following, you started Om Stars, like you do a bunch of stuff like to put yourself out there. Like, how did you make the switch between like, you know, the Kino before to all of a sudden like that you wanted to be like a kind of a force in the yoga community? Because I would consider you a force, just for the record.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So, you know, I remember practicing really, really intensively and feeling like I was never going to be good enough to be a teacher, and just practicing and practicing and practicing. And I still remember, you know, the first time someone asked me to teach or to share yoga with them. And I felt like, wow, this is amazing. I don't feel worthy at all, but I started. And then I, you know, started to practice and practice a little bit more and teach a little bit more and continue to go back to India and study. And then I, you know, I remember when I got requested to make a YouTube video for this online company called eHow. And they wanted to do some like short little yoga how-to videos. And then I remember filming the video and thinking it was really fun. And then the person who was filming said, "Hey, why don't you make your own YouTube channel?" And I was like, "Sure, let's try. Why not?" And then from there, I was really amazed and touched at how many people all over the world were watching. And one of the things I realized was that people who would come to, we were entering the age of social media where people's first interaction with traditions or learning would be through, you know, a YouTube search or YouTube video or Google search. So there was something inside of me that kind of really felt that it was important that voices that were steeped in the tradition were part of the architects of culture. And in the architecture of culture, most often what seemed to be happening was the elevation of, you know, popular voices. And so for me, it became important to sort of be a link between the ancient tradition of yoga within India, as I've learned it, towards the more popular expression of yoga, which is now really kind of gone worldwide. And so that was kind of my impetus and my desire to take the tools of traditional practice and spread those and make sure that stays in sort of the broad cultural architecture blueprint of what yoga is.
Gotcha. You know, it's funny too, because like as a Mysore teacher, you know, I'll give a person a pose and I'll teach it to them and they'll work on it for a couple of weeks and then they'll come back and they'll be like, you know, Taylor, I watched the Kino video on YouTube about Bakasana B or Karandavasana or something, you know, some difficult posture. And they're like, I think I have a better understanding of it. And I'm like, age of social media, YouTube. I mean, because I've watched them too. No, I have. I'm not kidding. You know, so it's definitely, you know, like you've definitely made an influence on all of that for sure.
Oh, well, thank you. I just, you know, when the day is done, I can only hope it's a positive influence, and I can only hope that people are, you know, stay inspired to practice, and that those little tidbits of wisdom lead, you know, that I found within my own body, if I can share those with someone else, that makes me happy.
And so I'm wondering, like, you know, because I feel like most of the Ashtanga people, and I'm not trying to be pointed, but I just really want to get your perspective on it. Like, you know, a lot of the Ashtanga people will say like stuff like, oh, she's went mainstream or whatever. And they're talking about how, like, you're teaching to different people instead of just Ashtanga people. Like, those are the only people worthy of your teaching or something like that. And so I'm wondering, like, was there a conscious shift to teach a greater audience at some point?
Well, I think that there was a desire in my heart to, you know, really spread the message of yoga. So, you know, the people who are already on the mat 6 days a week, like, they've got it. Like, you don't really need me. You know, you got it. You got the fire. You're a candle. You're burning. You're lit, you know? And so I was like, I want to be a catalyst for that person on the sofa who's sitting there watching Netflix, who's like, yeah, maybe I heard about yoga, but I don't believe it's for me. I was like, buddy, I want you to get off the mat and practice, because it's going to make your world a better place. I wanted to find people who thought, you know, yoga could never be for them. You know, people that thought, you know, Christians in the United States of America who think that, like, yoga opens them up to demonic possession, and be like, no, come and practice, because whatever you know of God, like, this will bring you closer into your relationship with God. If you want to know Jesus, then, you know, you do your practice, it'll open up your barriers so that you can know Jesus. You know, I want to find, that's what I was thinking. Like, I want to find people that haven't found this practice that could benefit from it. And that was kind of where I, you know, where I wanted to go. And then now I just feel fully embraced and embedded within that, to the extent of being willing to take primary series and dissolve it into its most basic elements, so I can teach my mom with her two total knee replacements, you know, something that I would still call Ashtanga yoga. So if that's mainstream, I'm fine with it, you know, and I feel like I'm good with that. I have recently started to teach a bit more traditional Mysore style practice, and that's really meaningful too. But I still really believe in finding those people who think that, you know, yoga is not for them, whether because they feel that they're too old, or they're the wrong size, the wrong shape. They feel that they can't do it because they, you know, have a mental health issue or a financial issue or something else that's coming up, and really reaching them and being like, hey, you can practice. You're worth it. Believe in yourself a little bit, just 5 minutes a day, just a sun salutation, some modified sun salutations, even just start practicing.
And is this like line of thought the reason why you started Om Stars?
Absolutely. You know, so one of, like, there are things that I realized was, so here's YouTube, and YouTube's great. And I, you know, posting videos on YouTube, I started to make some videos for some other online channels. And one of the things that I realized is, you know, YouTube is just this democratic thing. You just post it. You know, it's mostly democratic. You can, of course, like, boost your videos, and then because you have money behind it, more people see it. So there's that kind of shadow element, which wasn't there in the initial days of YouTube. So I guess I should say it was mostly democratic, which means that it's just like whatever's popular people look at. And then a lot of the online channels that were out there when I was making videos for, you know, people started to ask me to make videos for their channels, is that they were owned by people who were interested in, you know, having a fun idea about making videos and making a channel, but their primary, like, the end of day goal was about the bottom line. You know, it was like, well, is this going to be, you know, a driver of revenue? And it was all about, you know, maximization of bottom line for, you know, corporate profit. And when we're looking at that paradigm, it's like short-term profitability is key. And that was like, I felt that was a little bit of a sellout. And I was like, you know what? I don't really want to participate in this anymore. And I take issue that I felt like I was being commodified. You know, I felt like that there was this, like, I was being turned into like a product that one company or another, not any one particular one, but just that it was like, oh, well, this, we can take this and market this. And I was like, no, like, I'm not a commodity, and I'm not for sale, and neither's yoga. And so I wanted to create a channel online where people could find real traditional practice, where the emphasis, you know, wasn't on the bottom line. The emphasis was on, Is this a video that's going to support your practice? Are you going to be able to learn about the true history of yoga, the cultural history, the philosophical context of yoga, as well as understand the sort of depth, power, and presence that's available? Are there ways that we can support it, full immersion in the yogi lifestyle, and really, you know, speak to what it means to be a yoga practitioner in our contemporary global society? And that's kind of the dream of Om Stars, is to create this as very much an online community space of like-minded, dedicated yogis that are united around practicing, you know, the practicing in this kind of virtual communal space that, you know, support each other online, offline, and that we have traditional practice as well as, you know, more kind of lifestyle segments and really everything to support so many aspects right. of the yogi journey.
That's amazing. A lot of the people that, you know, have signed up for it have given great feedback. You know, some in my community and stuff too, have basically gave amazing feedback with a lot of the OMSTAR stuff. So keep it up.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that. That means a lot. You know, it's very much a labor of love. And, you know, 10 years from now, I really feel like I want us to be, you know, we want to have so much, we're so many more narratives and stories to tell around what it means to be a yoga practitioner in the world. And so I feel like, you know, we want to be, you know, Netflix for yogis, you know, and that's our kind of North Star, is that we're not only providing class content, but we're in the process of developing documentaries about yoga. We're in the process of telling more stories about what it means to be a yogi in the world. Yeah. And so I just thank you for the encouragement, and we'll keep going. And I can't wait to see where it is 10 years from now.
Yeah. And so what's your next big thing? I mean, are you done with like creating these things? It seems like you've created a lot over your years. Are you done, or do you have other things that you're shooting for?
Well, I really want to develop OMSTARs. Okay. Like, that's really, really important. I feel like we're just at the beginning there. And so there's so much more depth, and there's so many more aspects and avenues into that. And I think that's really, really important. I want to take a real deep dive into that. At the same time, you know, I do feel in this kind of transitional period, you know, I feel like, you know, that there is so much in the journey of yoga that's been internal and spiritual for me that I've written about a little bit, but I'm in the process of writing a new type of book that would not have any asanas, no yoga poses in it. So then this would be really a distillation of kind of the inner journey and the wisdom that's come, you know, through the practice to me. And it's, you know, it's a lot of work in a different way, but that's kind of the book project that I'm working on right
and
now.
And so let's talk about workshops. I mean, you know, like you're super busy with the workshops. Are you going to keep doing those? I mean, it seems like you're gone every, I'm surprised we haven't run into each other in the airport. Yeah.
In the airport. Yeah.
Seriously. So, but I'm wondering, are you going to continue to do those? Like, are you going to teach more Mysore style? Like what you mentioned just earlier?
Well, I started to add here in Miami now, something between 3 and 4 times a year, a week long Mysore intensive, where you can come and practice Mysore style with me. And it's limited to 30 students right now. We may increase it at some moment, but it's only 30 students. And so I'm starting to do some of those here in Miami, and that's really meaningful. I used to travel every weekend. So I used to be in a different city every single weekend. And now I want to travel, you know, between 1 okay. and 2 weekends a month. And so that's kind of where I am right now. And I'm sort of interested in that potentiality. I'm also interested in developing, you know, more programming online. We recently launched live streaming, and we're developing our mobile app right now with OMSTARs. And so there's some potential for me to develop a more in-depth online program. So that's kind of in the works also. And if that happens, then I could do it from anywhere in the world, but I probably want to, you know, just be in one place and situated and dive deeply into that. So I'm interested in depth right now, whatever that means and whatever shape that takes. I'm interested in diving in deeply.
Well, all the best to you. I really appreciate you being on the show today. Tell Tim we said hello. You know, it was an honor to have you on here and have your thoughts. You've been a great force and a great like inspiration for a lot of the yoga community, not only the Ashtanga community. And it's an honor to have you on the show. So I really appreciate you being on today.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure to be here and share this time with you. And I thank you for having me.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.